and "Hi, Jody, very pleased you can join us." He could only have been in his mid-30s, but his friendly, informal manner quickly put me at ease. "I thought we'd start with a tour of the school, then you can spend some time with Jody's class, if that sounds all right." "Fine," I said, then turned to Jody. "That sounds good, doesn't it?" She hid behind me, clinging to my skirt, all her bravado evaporated. He led the way through the double doors and along a short corridor. "There are 6 classrooms leading off the main hall," he explained, "which doubles as a canteen and gym." As we went in, I could smell the residue of boiled greens and gravy, one constant factor shared by thousands of schools all over the country. The walls of the hall, like those of the corridors, were lined with examples of the children's work, and Mr. West proudly described the various projects that had inspired this work. There were paintings, drawings, essays, poems, and computer printouts, all based on a handful of themes, such as faraway lands, water, animals, and designing a house. He was so enthusiastic and child-centred in his approach that I thought to myself, if this school can't cater for Jody's needs, then no one can. We arrived at Jody's classroom and the head knocked before we went in. A sea of faces looked up curiously before returning to their work. "Caroline Smith," he said, leading us to the class teacher, "this is Kathy Glass and this is Jody." We shook hands. "The lady over there is Mrs. Rice, the classroom assistant. She'll be helping Jody." I glanced over to the table and smiled. Mrs. Rice was a homely woman in her 50s, wearing a floral pattern dress. She gave us a little wave. Jody's confidence had increased during the tour, and she started wandering between the tables, peering over the children's shoulders. One boy shifted uncomfortably. "Jody, come here," I called, but she ignored me. "Don't worry," said Mrs. Smith. "They're just finishing a piece of creative writing from our literacy hour. She can look." Mr. West took his leave. "If you have any questions, I'll be in my office at the end of the day." I thanked him, then spent some minutes with Mrs. Smith as she explained how the tables were grouped. She suggested I have a look around, so I did, feeling intrusively conspicuous. I felt like a giant as I walked among the miniature tables and chairs. The blue group was obviously the brightest. Their writing was neat and detailed, with few grammatical mistakes. Mrs. Rice's table, the orange group, was a different matter. These children were struggling to produce a handful of legible lines, and their work was full of corrections. Nonetheless, even the weakest of these was well above Jody's standard. Jody could barely write her own name.
"Would you like to join your table now?"
Mrs. Smith called to Jody from across the room.
"The spare chair beside Mrs. Rice is your place."
Her request was gentle but firm. Jody, who apparently wasn't quite ready, sized her up. I could see Jody had one of her "take me on if you dare" expressions, and my heart was in my mouth. "Not now, Jody," I thought. "Please let's not have a refusal and a tantrum on your first visit." Now the other children were looking too. Presumably they were used to responding immediately to any request from their teacher. Jody stared at Mrs. Smith, but then, to my relief, she lowered her gaze and plodded heavily over, flopping in her chair with a dramatic sigh. Mrs. Rice gave Jody a pencil and paper. I crept round the edge of the room and perched myself on a stool by the window. The classroom overlooked the playground, and an older class was in the middle of a PE lesson. The room was quiet save for the occasional scraping of a chair and the hushed voice of Mrs. Rice giving assistance to her group. I noticed that there were more boys than girls and wondered whether, with their friendships already established, the girls would allow Jody in. The poor girl needed to make friends just as much as she needed the education, and children can be very forgiving if they feel it's justified. The children finished their essays and Mrs. Smith asked who would like to read one out. Half a dozen hands shot up, including Jody's. A boy called James was chosen first, and he'd written about the nighttime adventures of a fox called Lance. The story had a clear structure and used lots of adjectives, and when he was finished, The other pupils gave him a big round of applause. Next came Susie, whose story cleverly centred around the observations of a wise owl from his vantage point high up in the trees. I gathered from the content of the essays that they'd been told to write about nocturnal animals. Susie was given her round of applause, and the teacher said they had time for one more. Jodie's hand flew up again, waving for all she was worth. Mrs. Smith exchanged a glance with Mrs. Rice.
"Come on then, Jodie. Let's hear yours."
I cringed with embarrassment. I could see she'd only produced a handful of scribbles.
"Class, this is Jodie," said the teacher. "She'll be joining us from Monday."
Jodie stood up and proudly held the paper at eye level, as she'd seen the others do. She pretended to read loudly and confidently, but her story was simply a string of unrelated words, punctuated by the occasional owl and fox, with nothing intelligible in between.
"I saw the fox to see, and I said don't, and the fox was him, and he no, and then the owl, where he was, he got far, and Mr. Owl, watch it, I told you over there. So the fox went, and in the night, you see, I said, then they went, then the fox was at night, and the owl, but he was not, and I said, so I go to fox and the owl."
Fortunately, Jodie was oblivious to the nonsense she was producing. I looked at the blank stares of the other children and prayed they wouldn't laugh. After a couple of minutes, with no end in sight, the teacher thanked Jodie and told her to sit down. There was no applause, but neither was there any sniggering, and for that I was truly grateful. Jodie didn't appear to notice anything amiss at all. In fact, she was full of high spirits and rather triumphant. The last hour was given over to self-chosen activities, during which the children worked on any aspect they liked of the topics covered during the week. I walked round the classroom once more. Some of the children were on the computers, adeptly cutting and pasting, while others were devising crosswords, stories, or producing pictures to complement their writing. Jodie was drawing a series of large boxes and colouring them orange, blue, green, red, and yellow. She explained to me that these were the class's different groups. I praised her, impressed that she'd picked up this much. Then I wrote the names of the colours beneath them for her. 5 minutes before the bell, the children packed away their things and sat on the carpet in front of the teacher. They chanted, "Good afternoon, Mrs. Smith," and the teacher wished them a happy weekend. As they collected their bags and coats and filed out, the teacher asked Jodie how she'd enjoyed her first afternoon.
"Brilliant," she said. "I want to come every day, forever and ever."
Chapter 23. Grandad. One of the remarkable things about Jodie that I'd noticed right from the start was that she had absolutely no conception of time. She would discuss events from years ago as if they were happening right now. Equally, if we had something planned for a few weeks' time, she would expect it to happen immediately. The day after the school visit, she wanted to go again, and no matter how many times I explained to her that schools didn't open on Saturdays, she couldn't understand. Instead, she was convinced it was my fault. "It's Saturday," I explained for the fifth time. "No one goes to school on Saturdays. Be a good girl and take off your uniform, and we'll hang it up ready for Monday."
"No, don't want to. Shut up. It's mine and I'm going."
She sat cross-legged on the floor with her arms folded, angry and defiant. I crouched down. "I know it's yours, sweet, and so are all these other lovely clothes. How about you wear your new lacy tights, as we're going to see Grandma and Grandad later?" I took the tights out of the drawer and placed them with a skirt and jumper on the bed. "It's up to you, but they'll look very smart with your denim skirt." I left the room, came downstairs and made breakfast. Half an hour later, Jodie appeared in the clothes I'd laid out.
"Well done, Jodie. That's a wise choice."
Every situation had to be handled with infinite care if there was to be any chance of cooperation. I couldn't simply say, "Put on your shoes, it's time to go." Jodie would have to believe that it was her decision and that she was in control. I knew where this had come from. When Jodie was being abused, she had had no control over anything, so now she needed to be constantly in charge just to feel safe. Unfortunately for me, the result of this was that even the simplest request would be met with a stubborn refusal unless she could be persuaded that she herself had made the decision. I had to use diplomacy and coercion if I wanted anything done, and it could be very draining. A visit to Grandma and Grandad's was just what we all needed, to smooth away some of the tensions within the family and boost our morale. Jodie thought the world of my parents, as did Adrian, Lucy and Paula, and all the other children we had looked after. Mum and Dad were in their early 70s, and they were the archetypal grandparents, with endless patience and all the time in the world to indulge their grandchildren. As we arrived, Jodie was on good form and greeted my parents warmly. We all went into the living room when Jodie caught sight of my parents' dog, Cosmo, a rather sad, passive old rescue greyhound. Jodie suddenly screamed, then rushed across the room and started whacking him with her fists. The poor dog yelped, but Jodie was on top of him and he couldn't move. Dad and I rushed over and pulled her off, and I asked her what on earth she was doing.
"It looked at me!"
she shouted, still glaring at the frightened dog. She had never shown any fondness for animals, but she had a particular aversion to dogs. Perhaps it was because of her father's dog, or that in the pecking order she was used to, the dog was the one she could kick and hurt without any fear of reprisal. She certainly never had any empathy for anything more vulnerable than she was. "But it didn't mean any harm," I said firmly as my dad stroked the poor animal, then let him out into the garden. "Now behave yourself. We said we were going to have a good day, didn't we?" Jodie nodded sullenly.
"I tell you what," my father said, "why don't you help me feed the fish? They haven't been fed yet because they were waiting for you to arrive. We can all do it together if you like. How does that sound?"
Jodie liked that idea, so she took Paula's hand and the two of them followed my father into the garden while Cosmo watched from a safe distance. Adrian and Lucy, who considered themselves too mature for this kind of entertainment, sat in the living room listening to their MP3 players, which had so far kept them mute since Christmas. I joined Mum in the garden and helped her prepare lunch as we caught up on the latest news. As usual, I was soon doing most of the talking, and it was mainly about Jodie. I found it very cathartic to discuss abnormal behaviour in the context of my mother's very normal existence, and it helped that my mother was a good listener. "Anyway," I said at last, "hopefully we'll turn a corner soon. So tell me, what have you two been up to?" She recounted the various hobbies and interests which filled their very active retirement. Eventually the girls and my father streamed in through the kitchen door, while Jodie loudly enthused about the golden orbs which had come to the surface to feed. Mum and I served lunch, and I seated Jodie between the two of us. Her plate was piled high with chicken, roast potatoes, three vegetables and gravy.
"I wish I lived here," she said, gazing adoringly at Grandma.
"Mum believes everyone needs feeding up, even when it's obvious they really ought to be on a diet." As the meal progressed, I noticed Jodie taking more than a passing interest in my father, who was seated opposite her. She watched him intently as he peered down through his spectacles at his plate, then over them to retrieve his drink or to talk to one of us. I assumed she was wondering about the way he used his spectacles, which were only for close focusing. Mum offered a second helpings, and I limited Jodie's. She sulked at this, resenting the fact that my father had filled his plate, but he needed it. Age had thinned him down rather than piling on the pounds.
"Grandad?"
she asked suddenly, setting down her cutlery. He looked up over his glasses.
"Yes, dear."
"Are you Kathy's daddy?"
"That's right. She's my daughter."
She thought for a moment, clearly trying to work something out.
"So you're their granddaddy?"
She pointed at Adrian and Paula.
I smiled at Lucy, hoping she wouldn't be offended at Jodie's faux pas.
"Yes, that's right," Dad replied. "Well done."
She glowed at the praise, and I was impressed that she'd finally made the connection, which she'd struggled with since she first met my parents.
"So, if you're their granddad," she said, still watching him, "did you do naughty things with your willy to them when they was little, like my granddaddy did to me?"
Everyone fell silent. My father stopped eating and looked at me.
"Jodie, of course not," I said sharply. "I've told you before, normal families don't do these things. Granddad is a good man. Now finish your dinner. We'll talk about this later."
Jodie, blissfully ignorant of the shocking impact of what she'd said, picked up her knife and fork and carried on eating contentedly. My parents were shocked. I could see it in their faces. Jodie had asked her question with such ease, as if it were a perfectly natural assumption. We quickly changed the subject and talked loudly of other things, but meanwhile I was thinking about what she'd said. Her grandfather. I wasn't even aware she had grandparents. There was no reference to them in the records. I wondered if she was confusing Dad and Grandad, or if there really was a grandfather involved. Did this mean there was yet another abuser present in Jodie's life? Was there anyone who hadn't had a part in destroying her? I glanced at my father, who was still subdued after Jodie's bombshell, and wondered again at the great divide between healthy and abusive families. Could her perception ever be changed? Perhaps one day she'd be able to accept that what happened to her was abnormal and wrong, and that most families functioned very differently, but at times it seemed a forlorn hope. I kept a close eye on Jodie for the rest of the afternoon, and Mum helped her with some colouring and cutting out. We were never able to leave my parents without a final cup of tea and slice of homemade cake, and we didn't say our goodbyes until just after 6. There was an accident on the motorway, so it was well past Jodie's bedtime by the time we finally arrived home. I decided to leave asking her about her granddad until the following day, but as I tucked her into bed and dimmed the lights, she suddenly asked,
"Why didn't Granddaddy do naughty things to Adrian and Paula? Doesn't he love them?"
I looked at her in the half-light. She was snuggled deep beneath her duvet, with only her blonde hair visible, falling in strands across the pillow. How could I begin to unravel the confusion between normal affection and the warped gratification that she had known? "It's a different kind of love, Jodie, completely different from the one between two grown-ups. And what was done to you wasn't love of any kind. It was cruel and very, very wrong. You'll understand more when you're older." I wanted to leave it at that, to go downstairs and make a cup of coffee, then maybe sit in the lounge and read the paper. But if I didn't follow this up now, Jodie might have forgotten it in the morning, sucking the awful memory back into the black abyss of denial. With a now familiar surge of anxiety at what I was about to hear, I turned up the light a little and sat on the chair beside her bed. Her eyes peered over the duvet, and I stroked her forehead. "Jodie, pet, did your granddad hurt you in the same way your daddy and uncle did?" She shook her head.
"No, Kathy, they was nicer."
"They? How many granddads did you have?"
"Granddad Wilson and Granddad Price."
"So there were two, then, and how were they nicer, Jodie?" She thought for a moment as the lines on her forehead creased, and I hoped she was about to tell me that they'd taken her to the zoo or bought her an Easter egg, the kind of things normal grandparents do.
"They lay on top of me, but they didn't hurt. They just peed in the bed. It was because they loved me, Kathy."
She said it so matter-of-factly, she might as well have been recounting a trip to the zoo. "No, it wasn't. It was wrong, Jodie. Adults don't show love like that. What they did was cruel. It's got nothing to do with love. but I could see how ejaculation without penetration might have seemed kinder to her when compared with the other abuse. "Were Mummy and Daddy in the room when this happened?" I asked.
"Sometimes," she nodded, "and Uncle Mike, and someone I didn't know."
I held her hand and stroked her forehead. "Is there anything else? Can you remember any more?" She shook her head.
"Can I have a story now, Kathy? Topsy and Tim's new shoes?"
She wasn't upset, and I found that I wasn't either. I was becoming as desensitized as her. I read her the Topsy and Tim story, then said good night and went downstairs. I made a note of the conversation in my log, then stepped outside for a cigarette. As I stood there in the freezing night air, I wondered if there was a course I could take in basic psychotherapy. I decided not. If I made an amateur attempt to help Jody, it would probably do more harm than good. All I could do was continue along the same lines as I had been, using a common-sense approach which restated normality, but did little or nothing for the profound psychological damage that had already been done. Not for the first time since Jody's arrival, I felt completely inadequate. On Sunday morning, Jody was buzzing with energy, and I had to deal with a barrage of questions about school. Would she have homework? Was there playtime? Did the teacher have a husband, a daddy? Would it rain? Adopting my usual policy of trying to burn off some of her nervous energy, I took her out on her bike. "It's so cold," I remarked, pulling up my collar. "I think it could snow again."
"What snow?"
she asked, as we climbed the hill. I tried to remind her as best I could, telling her how much she had loved it earlier in the month when it had snowed over 3 days. But Jody suddenly decided that she wanted snow immediately, and became angry when I couldn't, or, according to her, wouldn't produce it. A full-scale tantrum ensued, and she lay prostrate on the pavement, banging her fists and demanding snow for a good 15 minutes. It would have been comical if I hadn't been so cold. When we got back to the house, I sat her in front of a video until dinner was ready. She was just as hyperactive after dinner and had another tantrum when I wouldn't go out to buy some ice cream. I managed to persuade her to take a bath and this calmed her down enough for bed at 7. Tomorrow would be her first day at school for more than a year, and I was praying that it would be a good one. Chapter 24. Friends. Jody was up and down all night. But in the morning she was bright and excited, whereas I was just exhausted. She changed into her school uniform and we only had one small hiccup when she demanded to wear her lacy tights, but I eventually managed to dissuade her. We arrived at school early, so we sat in the car for a while listening to the radio. Although Jody was excited, I could tell she was also a little nervous, and I was nervous too on her behalf. I held Jody's hand as we walked up to the school gates. I gave it a squeeze and we entered the school building. Mrs. Rice came and met us in reception. Because of Jody's learning difficulties, it had been arranged that I would hand her over to Mrs. Rice every morning and she would hand her back at the end of the day. I gave Jody a hug and watched anxiously as Mrs. Rice led her down the corridor. As soon as I arrived home, the phone rang. It was Jill. She'd received the notes I'd emailed on Sunday about Jody's granddad's, and she'd already spoken to Eileen. They had checked the records and confirmed that there were definitely no grandparents on the scene. It was done with such speed that I wondered if Eileen's manager had spoken to her. Jody's maternal grandmother was alive, but had fallen out with her daughter years ago, and there was no contact between them. Jody had never known her grandfathers on either side. There was a pause, as Jill waited for me to come to the obvious conclusion. "They're in the same category as the so-called uncles. Paedophiles in the guise of family members," I said. Jody had previously described some of her other abusers as uncles and aunts, but it appeared that these were not actual relatives. Rather, they were friends of Jody's parents, who had been described as family members as an easy way of introducing strangers into the home environment. "We think so. It looks as though Jodie's parents must have been part of a network. The police are running a check now for registered offenders, Jill replied. If the names Wilson or Price come up on their list for the area, they'll take them in for questioning. But I have to be honest, Kathy, I'm not optimistic. If these people haven't been convicted before, they won't be on the list. There's another thing, too. Eileen's had the results of the forensic medical back.
Yes.
Jill lowered her voice. It confirms that Jodie's been penetrated, but without DNA or third-party evidence, there's not enough for a criminal prosecution. She has been abused, but to get a conviction, you need to prove who was responsible.
Who on earth do you think must have been responsible? Isn't it clear that Jodie's telling the truth? The forensic result just confirms everything she's been saying.
I sighed.
So what now?
We keep going, and hope something comes up. Eileen's realised that Jodie's due for an LAC review. It's actually overdue. Is it all right if we have it at your house? She suggested Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Yes, that's fine.
Eileen wants Jodie to be there. I know, an afternoon off school when she's just started, and I know she won't be able to contribute anything, but Eileen's suddenly one for the rule book, and she is within her rights to insist. I felt the mixture of anger and frustration that so often seemed to dog me when dealing with Eileen. OK, I'll pick her up from school at lunchtime, I said, and after a quick goodbye, hung up. LAC stands for Looked After Children, which is the official term for children in care. An LAC review is a regular meeting required under the Children's Act and attended by all those involved in the child's case. The purpose of the meeting is to report on the child's progress and decide on any actions which need to be taken. Jodie's parents wouldn't be present, of course, because contact had been suspended, but the guardian ad litem, the child's social worker, her team leader, the headmaster, Jill, Jodie and myself would all be there. However, since Jodie was still functioning at the level of a 4-year-old, her presence was likely to offer little more than disruption. With Jodie at school, I vowed to make the most of my first free day in months. I sat on the sofa and started to plan my day. 3 hours later I woke up, and as I came to, I chided myself for the time I'd wasted. It was now 12:45, and I had less than 2 hours before I'd have to make the return journey to school. I rushed to the supermarket, but by the time I got home I realised I'd have to give up my fantasy of reading in peace for an hour. Still, I comforted myself, I must have needed the sleep. I was getting so little at night, and that was broken every few hours by Jodie's night-time torments. No wonder I couldn't keep my eyes open the minute I had the opportunity to relax. I arrived back at the school and waited by the gates, exchanging smiles with a few of the other mothers. Had they heard about Jodie already, I wondered. How would the other children have described her? Mrs. Rice appeared with Jodie jumping up and down beside her and told me Jodie had had a good day. This was confirmed in the car as Jodie wouldn't stop talking all the way home. She told me over and over again about all the children in her class, most of whom were now her new best friends. And she wanted all of them to come round for tea, just like Paula's friends did. Adrian, Lucy and Paula were already in when we got home, so Jodie had a new audience for her excitable monologue, and they listened with patience. It continued throughout dinner to the extent that I had to remind her to eat, which was definitely a first. She settled easily that night, as she was physically and emotionally exhausted, and I did much the same. Just after midnight, I was woken by the sound of Jodie sobbing on the landing. I pulled on my dressing gown, hurried out of my room and found her lying on the carpet outside Paula's bedroom. Her face was crimson and she could hardly breathe for crying. I put my arm around her and led her back to her room. I sat beside her on the bed and cuddled her until she was able to speak.
"Kathy," she said through sobs, "when I was at my school I had a friend, but then she wouldn't be my friend anymore."
I passed her a tissue and waited while she blew her nose.
"Don't upset yourself, pet. You'll make lots of new friends now." "But she was my best friend. and she came to my house, but then she wasn't allowed because of what I said.
My sleep-fuddled brain started to focus. Oh, what did you say? I'm sure it wasn't that bad. Friends fall out all the time, Jodie, even best ones. She shook her head.
I told her about Mummy and Daddy and Uncle Mike, and she told her Mummy and Daddy, and they said she couldn't come and play. Her Mummy said it was a bad house, but I'm not bad, am I, Kathy?
I held her closer to me. No, sweet, of course you're not bad. She meant what was happening to you was bad. It was never your fault. You mustn't think that. As I comforted her, my mind was whirring. She had told someone. Other adults had been made aware of the abuse. Could this be the third-party evidence that was needed to secure a prosecution? I was fully awake now. You did right to tell Jodie. Her Mummy and Daddy should have told the police instead of stopping her from playing. What was her name? Can you remember? It's important. She sniffed.
Louise Smith. She lived next door. I won't tell my new friends, will I, Kathy?
No, there's no need. You can tell me anything you want, and you know that I'll do something about it. She sniffed and managed a smile. Good girl. You did the right thing. Now, I want you to try and get some sleep. We don't want you tired for tomorrow. I tucked her in and stroked her forehead until her eyes closed. I was tense and focused. Jodie had had the courage to tell someone, but that courage had not only gone unrewarded, but in her eyes, it had led to further punishment, as she had been prevented from seeing her friend. I could imagine why Louise's parents had kept quiet. They hadn't wanted to get involved, and they'd wanted to protect their own child. However, by keeping quiet, they'd left an innocent victim open to further abuse. All they needed to have done was to make an anonymous phone call to the NSPCC, the social services, or the police, and that would have been enough to start an inquiry. Whenever this kind of allegation is made, the police or social services have to look into it. I went back to bed, but I couldn't settle. In the end, I gave up and went downstairs and made myself some hot chocolate. I stood in the kitchen, warming my hands on the hot mug. There were wider implications to what Jodie had said. Living next door, the Smiths must have seen the comings and goings. They probably knew who these so-called aunts, uncles and granddads were by face, if not by name. If the police interviewed the Smiths now, with the allegations out in the open, surely they'd have to tell the truth. I knew the council estate where Jodie had grown up well. I'd looked after kids from there before. It was a tight-knit, closely-bound community where everyone seemed to be in and out of each other's houses. How many other residents had known what was going on but remained silent, fearful of the potential consequences? How did they sleep at night? Chapter 25. Denial. But they must know something, I insisted to Jill when she phoned a few days later. They were in and out of each other's houses all the time. The girls were best friends. Yes, but the Smiths claim they still are friends. They say they're astonished by the allegations and have even offered to give a character reference for Jodie's parents. I'm sorry, Kathy, but I don't think we're going to get anything useful out of them. I went quiet. I could feel the walls of conspiratorial silence that had imprisoned Jodie closing in again, and it was frightening. So why did they stop their daughter from going to play if her parents were so bloody respectable? Well, they say they never did. Look, Kathy, I don't doubt what you're saying or what Jodie's said, but Eileen's actually spoken to them, and it seems there's no chance of them talking, and the police are of the same mind. If these so-called granddads were registered offenders, it would be different, but they're not. The fact is, all we've got is the word of a confused 8-year-old with learning difficulties who won't even speak to the police. It's not enough to bring a case. She's not that confused, I snapped. Not when it comes to this. She's clear and focused. I took a breath. There was no point shouting at Jill. I'm sorry, I'm just frustrated. It looks like they're going to go scot-free while Jodie has to bear all the consequences of being brave enough to tell the truth. I know it's frustrating, But Jodie doesn't need to know there won't be a prosecution. At least it's good for her that she's been able to disclose. But we'll have to accept that's as far as it's likely to go at present. The police have said they'll keep the file open in case anything new comes up. I'm going to have to distance myself, I said wearily. I'm becoming too involved. You wouldn't be such a good carer if you weren't, Kathy, and I'm still working on that respite. I haven't forgotten. I felt like going round to the Smiths myself and begging them, if necessary, to come forward. I stood on the patio smoking, working out what I would say. If I looked into their eyes, could I shame them into admitting what they knew? If I told them about Jodie's nightmares, about how her life had been destroyed, could I change their minds? I inhaled deeply, but as I stubbed out the cigarette, I realised I couldn't do it. It would have been a completely inappropriate, unprofessional thing for a foster carer to do, and I would probably have lost my job, and therefore lost Jodie. Besides which, I doubted it could have done any good. If they'd resisted the best efforts of the police and social services, they weren't likely to be swayed by me. I went inside and closed the kitchen door. Yet again I felt Jodie's frustration. I took some comfort from the fact that Jodie was finally in school and hoped that the routine of it would give her something else to occupy her mind. But this routine was doomed to be interrupted by constant reminders of her past. Thursday arrived, and I had to pick her up from school at lunchtime so that she could attend the LAC review. By 3 o'clock, there were 6 of us in my lounge, sitting with coffee and digestives. Astonishingly, Eileen had turned up a whole hour late, with no explanation beyond a half-hearted, "Sorry, I was held up." She proceeded to distribute copies of her agenda, and the meeting finally began. Jodie was suddenly the centre of attention for reasons she didn't understand, so naturally enough she played to the audience. With hands on hips, she strutted up and down, shouting instructions and telling everyone off for talking every time they spoke. She said she was playing at schools. Jill and I exchanged knowing glances. We had a feeling this might happen. Despite Jodie's disruptions, Eileen persisted in working through her agenda and raised her voice above Jodie's when necessary. It quickly turned into a circus. Adam West gave his report, which was minimal since Jodie had only been in school for 3.5 days. Then, as he had another meeting to go to, he made his apologies and left. Jodie wasn't happy at this. Why should he get to go back to school and have fun if she couldn't? She was on the point of a full-scale tantrum, which I averted by replenishing the biscuit and reassuring her she could go tomorrow. Because of Jodie's behaviour, I was constantly in and out of my chair, and as a result, I could barely contribute to the discussion. I was also uncomfortable, as I felt that talking about Jodie while she was there was demeaning for her and likely to reinforce the very issues and behaviour that we were trying to move on from. "Would you like to contribute anything, Jodie?" Eileen eventually asked. "This meeting is, after all, about you." "Contribute means to say something," I explained as Jodie gawped blankly.
"No!" she shouted. "And I've told you before to stop talking or you'll miss your playtime."
I was pleased the headmaster had left and was no longer here to see this Dickensian portrayal of his award-winning school. An hour and a half later, we were finally finished, having fulfilled the statutory obligation, but accomplished next to nothing. I would have liked us to address Jodie's desperate need for therapy, but this didn't seem to be an option until the childcare proceedings had been resolved. The team leader and the guardian left first, then Eileen made a move to follow. "It was nice meeting you again, Jodie," she said, tucking her notes into her briefcase.
"Was it?" she said. "Why?"
Eileen forced a smile.
"Because you're a lovely little girl."
The condescension and insincerity was evident even to Jodie. There was a moment's pause as her features changed into a set that I knew well, while Eileen remained blissfully ignorant of what was coming.
"No, I'm not!"
Jodie boomed in her deep, masculine voice.
"I'm Reg, and I'm angry. Have you locked up that fucking father yet?"
and before I could stop her, she kicked Eileen on the shin. I quickly enfolded and restrained her as Eileen rubbed her leg. "I'll see you out," said Jill, leading her down the hall. "That was very naughty," I said to Jodie. "You don't kick, whoever you are." But as quickly as Reg had appeared, he vanished, and by the time Jill returned, Jodie was sitting happily on the floor, engrossed in her Lego. "So, that's Reg," said Jill grimly. "I know you told me about this, but nothing prepares you for seeing it in action. It's so chilling. I've seen it before years ago, but my goodness, only the severest kind of trauma could provoke this in such a young child. This is the first time she's turned into Reg in front of strangers," I said. "Well, I'm pleased I've had the opportunity to witness this firsthand." "Yes, I expect Eileen was as well," I replied dryly. We both smiled. Now that Reg had been released in front of others, he had no hesitation in making another appearance, this time with a different audience. I'd just returned from taking Jodie to school when the secretary phoned.
"Hello, Kathy, we have a problem. Jodie's not hurt, but the head has asked if you could come straight away."
My coat was still on, so I retrieved my keys from the hall table and headed back, my mind racing. What could she have done now? When I arrived, the secretary showed me straight through to the head's office. He was seated somberly behind his desk, and I sensed that the distance between us was deliberate to emphasise the seriousness of the conversation we were about to have. "Thank you for coming so promptly," he said, briefly standing and waving to the seat opposite. "I'll come straight to the point. We've had rather an unfortunate incident this morning, which resulted in Jodie slapping another child's face." One incident of slapping wouldn't necessitate my being summoned before the head. We both knew that.
"I'll be perfectly frank, Mrs. Glass. It wasn't so much the slapping that upset the child and the rest of the class, but the behaviour that accompanied it."
I raised my eyebrows questioningly.
"Jodie was completely out of control over something really quite minor. She was kicking and shouting vile abuse, then blamed it on someone called Reg. We don't have anyone with that name in the class, but she was adamant. It took two members of staff to calm her down. Now, obviously, I haven't known Jodie for very long, but her reaction was very disturbing and seemed quite out of character." Out of character, indeed. I decided I had no alternative but to come clean. I told him about Jodie's DID and what we'd witnessed at home, then reassured him that there was a psychologist involved. I omitted to mention that the psychologist was only conducting assessment rather than therapy. I also touched on her two other characters, and he nodded in recognition. "Mrs. Rice mentioned that Jodie sometimes talks in a babyish voice. We had put it down to nerves, you know, how children can regress when they're anxious. But you're saying it's part of the same problem?"
"It could be, yes."
"And presumably her social worker's aware?"
"She is. Even more so after yesterday," I thought.
"And you say it could disappear of its own accord?"
"That's what I've been told, yes."
"Normally we'd exclude a child for the rest of the day after an incident of this nature, but there seems little point if she doesn't even know what she's done. I'll keep her here and monitor it."
I thanked him and asked him to pass on my apologies to the other child and the staff.
"I'll speak to Jodie later," I said, feeling duty-bound to offer something. "I'm sorry you've had to deal with this in school."
I came out of the office aware that I'd had a narrow escape. It was clear that Mr. West wouldn't tolerate Reg's behaviour indefinitely. I spoke to Jodie about it that evening, but it was a waste of time. Sometimes she appeared to remember nothing at all, and sometimes she appeared to know what I was talking about when she blamed it on Reg or Amy. We could both begin to lose our sanity if we went on too long trying to work out what was happening. As far as she was concerned, I was accusing her of something which she herself hadn't done, and I didn't pursue it for fear of undermining the trust that she'd placed in me. Yet again, this was another incident which demonstrated that Jodie desperately needed therapy to start as soon as possible. It simply wasn't good enough to wait until the end of the court proceedings. I decided to pressure as much as I could for treatment to begin.
"She does need to be in therapy. the psychologist agreed when I took Jodie for her next appointment at the clinic the following week. How long is it until the final court hearing?
It's set for May. That was almost 4 months away.
She sighed and rolled her eyes. And have you noticed any improvement generally? I looked at Jodie, walking in circles in the middle of the room, muttering to herself.
She hasn't defecated for some time, and on a good day I have some level of cooperation, although she's plagued by flashbacks even then. Yesterday she was convinced she could see her dad's face on the curtains in the lounge.
She was hallucinating.
Yes, but it was completely real to her. She said I must have let him in without telling her, and she was hysterical. At night she wakes up screaming, and when I go in she's convinced there are people in the room who want to hurt her. I can see her eyes focusing on them, even though she's staring at blank space. It can take hours to reassure her. She seems to be actually reliving the pain she felt at the time. I shuddered. My family find it very upsetting.
They would. With post-traumatic shock, the abuse is constantly being revisited. Are you having regular breaks?
I smiled stoically. I'm still waiting. There's a problem in identifying suitable carers because of the level of Jodie's needs.
She made a note in her pad, then looked at her watch. Kathy, there's one more test I'd like to do with Jodie. Would it be all right if you waited outside?
It's just a game, she reassured Jodie, who clung to my arm, wanting to come with me.
I sat on one of the chairs in the corridor, and Dr. Burrows closed the door. It may have only been a game, but Jodie was in no mood to play. I could hear her shouting at the doctor to shut up and go away.
Dr. Burrows' even tone persisted for 10 minutes. Then the door opened and Jodie rushed out.
"Blimmin' doctors!" she cursed. "Why don't they mind their own fucking business?"
She had reached the exit by the time I caught up with her. Over the following weeks, Jodie continued to enjoy school, although there was no noticeable improvement in her behaviour or condition. In fact, rather than the school having an effect on Jodie, it seemed instead that Jodie was affecting the school. One afternoon, when I arrived to collect Jodie, I noticed that Mrs. Rice's eyes were red and puffy. "Are you okay?" I asked, hoping this wasn't too intrusive.
"Yes, I'm fine," she laughed, still sniffling. "I just got a bit emotional."
"Oh, I hope it's not anything that Jodie's..."
"No, no, no. Well, not exactly," she interrupted. "Actually, could I have a quick word?"
Mrs. Rice obviously didn't want to talk in front of Jodie, so I sent her off to run around the playground for a few minutes while Mrs. Rice and I walked over to a quiet spot. Some of the children had their hearing tests today, and Jodie started talking in class about some kind of medical she'd had. We were pleased that she had something to contribute, obviously, but then suddenly she started saying these awful things about... She said she preferred it when a man did it, and it became clear she was talking about... Well, you know...
"Oh, I am sorry.
She doesn't know the difference between what's appropriate and what's not."
"No, it was fine. I interrupted her before the other kids twigged, but she seemed to want to talk about it, so I spoke to her at playtime, just the two of us. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure you were aware of the details. The only new aspect seemed to be that she mentioned an aunt being involved, as well as her mother, but she didn't give a name for the aunt. That was all."
"Okay. Thank you for letting me know. She has told me about the aunt before. I'm really sorry you've had to deal with all this."
"Oh, don't worry. I'm sure it won't be the last time."
She smiled. I patted her on the arm and Jodie and I headed home. On the Friday, the school held a fete for comic relief. The sun was out, so the stalls were set up in the playground rather than in the hall, as had been expected. The children wore red, the teachers wore wigs and silly costumes, and even some of the parents were wearing red plastic noses. There were stalls with sweets and cakes, games and tombolas, and a set of stocks where the braver teachers allowed themselves to be pelted with wet sponges. It was great fun, and Jodie revelled in it. I stood watching her as she haired around the playground, being chased by three of her classmates. They were all soaking wet, and their faces were flushed with the excitement.
Jodie's pigtails swung in the air as she dodged and ran from her new friends, laughing wildly. It was probably one of the happiest moments of her life.
Chapter 26. Links in the Chain. The school handovers were not just designed to ensure Jodie's safety. They also allowed the teaching assistant and me to keep each other fully updated with Jodie's progress. Each morning I gave Mrs. Rice a brief summary of how Jodie had been the night before, how she'd slept, what her mood was like, any problems to look out for, and so on. In the afternoon, Mrs. Rice would do the same for me, which was useful, especially when Jodie was upset or angry at school. As Jodie settled into her class, she seemed to get on reasonably well with the other children, largely because most of them were bright enough to stay on polite terms with her while keeping their distance. However, there was one other pupil in the orange group who had behavioural problems, a boy called Robert, and he was Mrs. Rice's other main charge. She sat between Jodie and Robert in class and spent most of her day working with the pair of them on a one-to-two basis, keeping their work loosely related to what was going on in the broader lesson. This kind of teaching is known as differentiating work. One afternoon, as Jodie trudged unhappily down the steps, Mrs. Rice explained to me what had happened. The class had been drawing with pastels, and Robert and Jodie had both reached for the red pastel at the same time. Robert got there first, so Jodie sat back in a huff. She glared at her picture, glared at Robert, then got up out of her chair, walked behind Mrs. Rice, and grabbed the pastel out of Robert's hand. Robert started crying, and Mrs. Rice naturally told Jodie off and made her hand it back. Jodie was furious and shouted that it was Robert's fault and called him Four Eyes. This upset Robert even more, as he'd only recently started wearing glasses, and Jodie was eventually persuaded to apologise. When the lesson finished, the children went out for playtime. In the playground, Jodie spent some minutes standing in silence while staring at Robert. Then she walked over and punched him, and the pair of them had to be separated. On the way home, she was still furious, thumping and kicking the back of the passenger seat.
"He's bullying me, Kathy! I hate him! I hate him!"
Jodie often had tantrums in the car, as she knew there was little I could do to stop her.
"Jodie, calm down and sit still. I won't tell you again." "No, shut up!"
"Jodie, there'll be no television tonight, I'm warning you. You haven't had the best of days. Enough!" She pouted in silence, and I tried to explain the rationale behind her being told off.
"You grabbed the red pastel from Robert, then called him a very hurtful name. That's why Mrs. Rice was annoyed." "Yes, but I needed it. Why won't anyone believe me?"
Over the following weeks, Jodie's complaints about Robert became a regular feature of our drives home, and often our evenings too. Jodie was adamant that Robert was bullying her, no matter how many times it was explained to her that she, in fact, was bullying him. I did feel sorry for Robert. He was a quiet, anxious boy with more than enough problems of his own, and Jodie brought out the absolute worst in him. Jodie's relationship with Robert was just one of numerous problems at the school, and I quickly came to dread the sound of the secretary's voice, as it usually meant we were in trouble. However, the next worry I was faced with regarding school was unrelated to Jodie's behaviour. One evening at dinner, she was telling me about her classmate Freya, and my attention had wandered. Jodie's stories tended to ramble and rarely had a point or resolution. However, when Jodie mentioned Freya had visited her at her old house, I quickly paid attention.
"Did you say Freya came to your house when you lived at home?"
"Yeah."
"The house you grew up in, with your mummy and daddy?"
"Yes,"
she sighed. "And she's in your class now?"
"Yeah."
"So were you and Freya friends from your last school?"
"No, she didn't go to my school."
"So how did you know her?"
"Because she came round, and we played Barbie."
"So did your mummy and daddy know hers?"
"Yeah, from the pub."
"I see. And do they still see each other, do you know?"
"Suppose so."
Oh, shit, I thought. The next day at school, I went in to see the head. If Freya's parents were still friendly with Jodie's parents, it was almost certain the news of which school Jodie now attended would filter back. This raised the possibility that her parents might come to the school and confront us, or even try to snatch her. Jodie would be terrified at the sight of her father in what she thought was a safe place, let alone if he approached her. The school run is fraught with anxiety when you're fostering, as you're an exposed target. Parents do occasionally try to grab their children at the school gates, and the advice we're given is that we have to let the child go and call the police. The head suggested that Jodie and I should use the staff entrance from now on, and he gave me the security code. Although this was a sensible precaution, it meant that in yet another small way, Jodie had been made different from her classmates, and her past was once again hampering her future. The following Sunday, Jodie, Paula and I went for a walk in the park. We were walking up the hill through the centre of the park when an elderly lady coming towards us slipped and fell. It was dreadful to witness. Her wrists failed to break her fall and she cracked her nose on the tarmac. Paula and I ran up to her and I gave her first aid while Paula phoned for an ambulance on her mobile. I used a wad of clean tissues from my bag to stem the bleeding, all the while talking to her, making sure she didn't go into shock. Her name was Maureen, and she was clearly badly shaken. Her frail body was trembling, her face was grazed, her nose appeared to be broken, and one of her wrists had swollen up. We waited until the paramedics arrived and explained to them what had happened. The ambulance took her off to hospital and we returned home. Throughout all of this, Jodie had stood by, quietly watching. That evening at dinner, it was still on our minds.
"I hope that poor woman's all right," Paula said. "I could have cried." "What do you want to cry for?"
Jodie asked.
"That poor lady who fell over in the park."
"Why? She didn't hurt you?"
"No, I know that," Paula said patiently. "But she was badly hurt and she was old. When you see something like that, it makes you sad, doesn't it?"
Jodie stared back at her, clearly not understanding the emotion she was trying to describe. I decided to try and help. "We don't like to see other people get hurt, Jodie, because we know how bad it feels ourselves. If you'd fallen over, you'd be hurt, wouldn't you?" Jodie thought for a second.
"Yes, that poor lady."
She then repeated the phrase throughout the rest of the evening. I was glad to hear her making the right noises, but it sounded hollow and I wasn't actually convinced she felt it. It wasn't that Jodie was being willfully callous, she just didn't seem to have any sense of empathy. I wondered if this was why she could be so cruel to animals and so rude and violent to other people. In all the time she'd been with us, I'd never once seen her cry out of sadness. Her tears had only ever come from rage and frustration. However, although she hadn't yet learned to empathise, she had learnt that people expected her to sound sympathetic